Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Monday morning at 11am here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the Bush Residential Unit in Hengrove for disabled people, a respite care centre. It looks as if the funding's going. Also, the death of computer whiz kid Aaron Schwartz, the author of Reddit. We speak to Ed Lander. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. But we start this week with the Bush Residential Unit. Hi, Rita Lynch, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi there.
Can you just tell us, first of all, for those that haven't heard, don't know about it, what is the residential unit, Bush Residential Unit?
The Bush Residential Unit is a unit for disabled children to provide respite for their parents so the parents can have an overnight break. So the child will stay for one night, maybe a whole day and one night, or maybe two nights, whatever, depending on need. And it means that the parent can have a break and then carry on with their good work of looking after the child and in a good way, and to help keep families together, because raising a disabled child is extremely difficult.
Okay, your son Jimmy Lynch uses the centre. You use it, I suppose, as well, you could say.
Yes.
Tell us what actual practical things day-to-day does it mean for you as a family?
Well, it kind of saved our lives, really. My son has been using it for over 3 years and staying overnight. And what it means for me is that I know he's safe, he's well looked after. There's a team of staff there who are trained, experienced and professional, and they understand his needs. There's no child that they haven't seen before in some ways. You know, they can cope with any child. There's five beds for the younger ones, five beds for the older ones, so they're kind of separated, which is good. They've got a really big outside play area. They've got a sensory room, a little padded room if children get a little bit upset and need to calm down. They've got a soft play, computers, bicycles. It's got all these facilities that, as a normal parent, I can't always, I can't provide just in my home. And on the night he goes, they take the three other boys with my son swimming. So he has exercise and he loves swimming. It's also social. It's a place where he can kind of talk to and meet other true peers, you know, other children similar to him. Because it's very difficult for autistic children to make friends. So it provides them with a whole social thing that I can't always provide. And it's almost like a sleepover. And over the years, I've really learned to trust staff. And my son, Jimmy, just loves going there, which he doesn't always like to be away from me. But it's the one place he always, always loves going. And it's been amazing for us as a family.
So the City Council is implementing the government's austerity cuts. And this is part of it. I mean, this is the sharp end of it all, isn't it?
Yes, I was really surprised because I didn't think that they would actually disturb people like us, you know, quite severely disabled. I thought they would leave us alone because life is hard enough. But it was quite shocking. And so what they want to do is, and what they're doing, is taking away 5 of the 10 beds so that the Bush then will be operating at half what it used to. I think it's been going for about 30 years as well. So it's been a really tried and tested centre, and it will... Yeah, they'll lose 5 beds.
Now, that does seem a little bit strange, because surely they could be cutting other things. There are all sorts of services from the City Council. I would have thought this is one of the most important, really.
I would have thought it's one of the most important because, you know, you never know who's going to... I mean, apparently what they're saying is there's more and more disabled children coming up through the system, and there's only one pot of money that can't be made bigger. That just can't happen. It's just got, the pot of money has got to be made to stretch. So they're taking from some disabled children to give to others, and that's kind of how they're trying to, and that's why they're taking the 5 beds from the Bush. And also I would have thought that these children who go to the Bush aren't just a little bit disabled. They are severely disabled, some with physical and mental disabilities. I would have thought that given that there's only 15 beds in the whole of the Bristol area that provide for these children, that they would have just, if anything, given more beds, not taken away.
Can you just give us an idea for Jimmy? He's 13, I think, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Give us an idea of the sort of support that he's getting at the moment through Bush and what he may lose if he loses his place there.
if he loses his place, he will lose, well, the swimming that he goes to, which isn't with me, because he's very mummy orientated, so, which is another great thing about the bush. It takes him into a safe environment, but away from me.
Well, it's helping him grow up, isn't it? It's helping almost him, like a completely able-bodied child.
It's the most normal thing we've got. It's the closest thing we've got to normal. And that's why it's so devastating that they think it's so very... That it's so easy just to take from these children and from their parents. So our lives will change a lot without the bush. Obviously, we will survive because as a carer, and because I love my son, I will of course struggle on no matter what. But you know, we struggle enough, and the bush has been just so great for us that it will impact very badly on us. The council staff have said that Jimmy won't lose his place, but already. A social worker has been in touch saying that there's going to be a big meeting. Already they're trying to decide what children will be kicked out of the bush and what children will be allowed to stay. And also with reduced beds, it means that in future only the very severely disabled children will be able to access the bush, which means it won't be such a great social network.
No, I mean,
place.
It would seem to me it's actually really good for the severely disabled to actually spend a lot of time with the less severely disabled,
yeah.
to really just to make them feel like they're just a little bit more able-bodied, you know. It gives
absolutely.
Them that sensation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And also they learn from the ones who are a little bit more, you know, doing a bit better, you know, they learn from them. So it's going to be a terrible loss for lots of people.
Well, what have the council said to you as an excuse for this? Because there doesn't really seem to be a reason. I mean, things like the council spend money on subsidising big business, on partnerships with big business and this kind of thing. And I can't understand why any council with any kind of moral conscience would think that it's okay to stop providing care for whatever it is, 5 disabled people.
What they're saying is instead of the bush residential unit, they're saying that foster parents is their big thing, because they know they have to provide some respite because there's actual laws in this country that say that parents of disabled children have got to, yes, which is, you know, really great. But so they're saying that foster care will be the alternative to the bush. So one foster parent will provide everything that the bush is providing. They're saying that this is a cheaper alternative. What they're saying is by getting rid of the 5 beds, they're going to release more money, so more parents and more disabled children will be able to get respite. What the parents have been saying is that the foster care is not equivalent to or comparable to the bush because it isn't as safe and it just won't have the facilities, but they're going with it anyway because it really, ultimately, it's about saving money.
Well, we also had, just after the beginning of this coalition government, the Lib Dems and the Conservatives, the closure of Remploy, which was set up after World War II with help from Winston Churchill. Even though it was a Labour government, Winston Churchill got involved and set up a specialist network right throughout the country of workplaces specifically designed for people of all sorts of disability. The idea being really to make sure that there were specific workplaces for disabled people if they wanted to work, and also that there was specific care at those places for disabled people, and they also were able to sort of self-support each other and network. Now, a lot of these things seem to have gone. It's quite clear to me that the Remploy was got rid of straight away after the general election because it was extremely unpopular, and they wanted everyone to forget about it by the time it came to the next general election next year in 2015. Hopefully everyone will have forgotten about the closure of Remploy and what it was and how important it was. But what are your thoughts, Rita, about the general way things are going for the disabled in Britain and the government policy towards the disabled?
I would say that, I mean, I'm quite shocked, but I find myself saying that I would say that there is almost a war on disabled people because they know they're not able to speak up and kind of fight for themselves. And because it's kind of almost playing into people's inbuilt prejudice around disabled people that really should they be here and are they taking our resources? And I think I think we have to kind of question our prejudices about disabled people, specifically about mentally disabled. And it's really, really frightening times, really frightening times. And with the residential parking, for instance, apparently the mayor of Bristol has said that blue badge holders won't be able to park on residential parking except at his judgment, which basically means that disabled people won't really be able to park anywhere if the residential parking is put in as much as he wants it put in. So it's very frightening times. And
Almost like that. He seems to be behaving like the Sheriff of Bristol or something, the Sheriff of Nottingham style character who's in charge of everything, you know.
Yes, I'm decreeing this,
I'm decreeing that. It's a bit strange. But anyway, what do you think of George Ferguson, the mayor's role in all of this, particularly with his decision about the Bush residential unit? Have you been able to appeal to him directly? And if so, what's he said?
Well, I've been asking to meet with him for ages, but he has just avoided that. He hasn't really said anything of any value to me anyway. And I think he's a bit of a coward because he's made this judgment to get rid of the five beds. I was on BBC Points West and the woman who ran the programme, I can't remember her name, wanted to do a programme with me and George Ferguson on, but he doesn't want to go on the television to kind of stand up or justify his decision. So I can only think the man is a big coward, and it's quite easy for him to take away from disabled people because it's easy pickings, really, but he won't front it and he won't stand up and...
Interesting, isn't it, that he used to be a merchant venturer. His old merchant venturer banker friends and investor friends have got billions of pounds swishing around in their bank accounts. I would have thought they could dip into that possibly to help with the Bush residential unit.
Yes, absolutely. I don't see why he can't. Apparently he's a very, very rich man. He owns loads of property, but obviously he just can't do that. That just can't happen. It's like a natural law. Rich people just can't help poorer people. And it's a shame. It's a terrible shame. I mean, I was at the council meeting when he made the decision to cut the five beds, and I was absolutely devastated, even though I kind of was aware it would probably happen. I just think it's a terrible indictment on our society and on the times that we're living in now.
It's interesting, isn't it? Almost like it was done as a point of principle rather than because it had to happen.
Yes. Because if they were a little bit unsure about maybe the Bush wasn't maybe running at full capacity, why take it away half the beds? I mean, the Bush has been going for 30 years. It's provided so much help for disabled people and their carers. They could have just, you know, redefined it somehow, but just to take it away...
I mean, it doesn't make any sense to sort of just take away beds. I mean, that doesn't make any sense at all. Have they had to reduce the number of staff? Is that what basically they're saying?
Well, I think they will. Yeah, they will. Yes. So they'll save money that way by reducing the amount.
That's the only saving they're going to make, though, through staff. I mean, that sounds to me, as if it's going to, you know, not necessarily even save money. If you've got at least the same facilities there and you're half closing the facilities, I suppose they're saying in a way that nothing is untouchable now.
Yes, absolutely nothing. Because for a while I thought that the disabled people were a little bit untouchable. I thought they wouldn't dare, nobody would dare, because it would make this society look too bad, but they obviously don't really care anymore. And I believe that once they've taken these five beds, it will only be a matter of time before they get rid of the Bush altogether, because there used to be a day centre there about 7 years ago and that was got rid of. So basically they're trying to deprive disabled people of any good opportunity, really.
You know what they'll be saying is, I'm afraid it's not economic anymore.
It's not economically viable, really. No.
That's what they'll say.
And also because a lot of disabled people won't grow up and make money for the economy. But
I would like to know how any kind of caring for the disabled is economically viable. It's not economically viable.
No, well, you can't put a price tag on everything. You just can't. And I don't
think thought we
really...
paid our taxes for things like this.
Well, we do, and I can imagine most people, if you ask them, would they like to live in a society where disabled people are well looked after, they would be happy about it, because nobody wants to see some of these disabled children out on the streets or disabled adults. And I thought that's what the tax money was going for, but in these very difficult times, obviously not. I think there's a bigger agenda as well, tapping into the mindset of people that we all have a prejudice against disabled people, and I think it's very frightening times.
Okay, Rita, well, thanks very much for coming in. And
thank you.
And let us know what happens with Jimmy and if they still let him stay there. It'd be nice to follow the story in the future, because I think really it's shameful that the mayor has behaved in the way that he has over this. I mean, he could quite easily have allowed this to stay open.
Yes,
but he has the final say, and
he's
looked the other way in this case with these disabled people, which is appalling. Anyway, Rita, thanks for coming in again.
Thank you. Cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now, car hacking. This is a feature that we did promise you last week, if you didn't notice. Well, we didn't manage to do it last week. We're doing it this week instead. It's Sherry Townsend. And she is a mum who's taken her car her Audi, her Toyota, whatever it is, I'm not sure she'll tell us, in to get it fixed, only to find that rather than some little problem with a warning light on the dashboard, it's actually going to cost her £800, and her car, it seems, has got a virus on its computer. I wonder, was it the car repairers when they put the car onto the diagnostic port that gave it the virus in the first place? Anyway, over to Sherry now. Could you introduce yourself and tell us what happened with your car?
I'm Sherry. My car, Volkswagen Passat, took it into the garage to get fixed because on the steering wheel you can get the volume up and down, you can answer your phone on the steering wheel, you can press a horn on the steering wheel, an airbag, and everything went, and it told you digitally on the car what was wrong, little signs come up, so of course then you can look and see what's wrong.
Right, these modern cars have got loads and loads of digital readouts, displays, yes, and things like that, haven't they? And quite often they say, you must take me to the garage.
And well, a lot of people haven't got a clue what they are without knowing to go to garage anyway, so...
Happens is people often just drive around with this thing on flashing on the dashboard saying, you must take me to the garage, because they know that it's just another way to get the owner to pay some money to do something which is maybe not even
better necessary.
I even had a friend whose car stopped going more than 30 miles an hour. It would limit his speed down to 30 miles an hour before he took it in. Have you?
Yep.
With your Volkswagen?
No. That was with an Audi A4.
Right, so Audis as well. Oh, right.
But anyway, this is going back about 8 years.
Audis, I know, were one of the first cars, like Toyotas, to have problems with unintended acceleration, which is this quite a nice term for the car accelerating very fast without you actually putting your foot on the pedal. A lot of this was blamed on things like car mats by Toyota, but the fact of the matter is the car's got a computer, and when you press that accelerator, it says to the computer, please, can we go a bit faster? And the computer then does it. So there's no real direct connection between a lot of the things that you're doing. Now, with the Volkswagens as well, and some other cars, they do automatic parking. So the computer is actually moving the steering wheel. So there's an actuator for the steering wheel on the computer.
I don't have that.
So tell us what happened with the Audi, first of all.
Right, with the Audi, well, I was going along Beggarbush Lane, and there was this little puddle. But as I went through the little puddle, it was a bit bigger than I anticipated, and, well, and carried on going, so it didn't go in the exhaust. But then what happened was the car wouldn't go faster than 20 miles an hour, but when I got it home the next day, it would, because apparently what it does, or what I read up that it does, it's a safety mechanism, because there's something wrong with the car, but the car wants you to get home safely. So that happens. Of course, I carried on driving it, thinking, oh, it's okay now. Ooh, no. And every now and then it would slow down and you couldn't get over 30. But then every now and then you could.
Oh. What about
the Volkswagen?
The Volkswagen.
Okay.
Bearing in mind that many of these cars with computers nowadays do these things, like I say, where they park themselves. So you press a little button. There's clearly some sort of connection between the computer, the car's computer, and the steering wheel.
Yep,
problem being, I don't think there should be, personally, because what happens if something goes wrong and at 80 miles an hour, for example? Maybe that's what happened to Diana in her Mercedes. You know, you're going along at 80 miles an hour and suddenly the car decides, right, we're going left. You know. Anyway, so what happened with you?
What happened with me, even the garage couldn't answer that, because garage phoned up Volkswagen, because apparently in the steering wheel and
so why did you take it in to start with? You were talking about the airbag.
The airbag went.
Oh, it just popped.
It didn't pop out. It told me I had no airbag, so I had to take it into the garage.
Oh, it disappeared.
A sign
came
up. It wasn't working.
Needed servicing.
Airbag. Of course, yes. Yes,
I've
and
never
the
heard
car's
of that
only a few years old as well. Right, yeah, I know. Not best pleased. I won't tell you how much it'll cost. Right, so had to take the car into the garage, took it in. They looked at it and said, the reason that I wasn't able to answer the phone, I wasn't to turn the volume up, because you can do everything. You could even change gears if you want to have the option of using gears on the steering wheel.
Right.
So everything's doing this. Apparently it's one little clip. So the garage I go to got in contact with Volkswagen, and Volkswagen said, yes, okay, you need this clip. So the garage bought the clip. So I took the car down to the garage, left it there all day to get fixed. They put the clip in.
So is this a new airbag that they put in?
No, it was a clip. A clip went, well, that's what I was told, a clip or a switch or something went.
Oh, a clip that
was
maybe
all
that
they had
holds
to do.
The airbag in?
No idea to control
a
it.
Clip.
But when they put this clip or
this is probably a little bit of metal that costs about 5p.
It gets better. Not even that, probably a can thing. Anyway, so they put this in And it took them all day to do it. And they kept coming out because I went an hour early back to collect my car because I'm bored. And they said, oh, no, sorry, it won't be long. Another hour, won't be long. And they said, really sorry to do this. You're going to have to come back again. We've just contacted Volkswagen and they've told us we're really sorry. But, you know, they sold them the piece as well. But the car has to be taken to Volkswagen because they've got to update the computer. It doesn't make sense, does it?
They've got to update the computer. What is this, a new software?
No idea. Yes, software. They had to update the computer.
But hang on a minute. Surely that, if you've got a software upgrade of some sort on most computers, surely it's just a fairly simple job to upgrade the software. You don't have to go back to Volkswagen.
I don't know. But what I don't understand is why Volkswagen said to them, here's the switch. So the garage bought the switch to allegedly have the car roadworthy because I had an MOT coming up. But where this was going on for ages and ages, and then, of course, when your car runs out of MOT, you're not legally allowed to drive it. So, of course, I couldn't drive the car for a week. So that was more stress that I had going on that was very unfair. And it was just carrying on and on.
So, ultimately, you had a little light up on your dashboard, yeah, telling you there was something wrong with your airbag. The garage tells you it's a little clip, which, yep, sounds to me like maybe 20p, something
no
like
idea
that.
What, yeah, a clip or a switch
do
or
you,
something.
Do you know how much this is at the moment going to cost you?
To get everything done, to go through the MOT for a new car, it was...
Well, forget the MOT for a minute. Right. Just
I don't know how
repairs.
Much that was, but for everything that was done on the car, it was a lot.
Come on, tell us roughly.
To go through the MOT, it was over £800.
God.
But there was other things had to be done as well. So, but yeah, and that's for a new car. It's only a couple of years old, like 3 years old.
Yeah, but it's also a bit strange, isn't it, that you've got a small little thing goes wrong with you. You know what I'd be inclined to do if a little light appeared on my dashboard saying there was something wrong with my airbag? Ignore it.
I got kids in the car. I'm unable to physically do that.
So. What about getting an older car that doesn't have all these sort of lights and bells and whistles?
I car share with someone, so, and it works for me. It's in my benefit to car share at the moment. But if I do have to get my own, then yes, it will be probably an old Toyota truck that just lasts through everything with no computers. Back to basics.
What do you think, thoughts about these kinds of technologies, though? Because it does seem to be sort of ranged against the consumer.
Me.
And if the... car manufacturer, Audi, Toyota, Volkswagen, whoever they are, says, well, you've got to get this done.
But you can only you've got to get it done. You can only get it done with them. That's so unfair. Now, if for them to sell the pieces, if they'd have told them, then you have to go to Volkswagen to get it done. I could have arranged, okay, and could have arranged a point for that to be done. Because I didn't know, then that took time. And then when they say, oh, you have to come in and get it done. Oh, but you have to wait 2 weeks till we can do it. Really? It's inconvenience for everyone.
Maybe roll back the technology a little bit. Do you think these car manufacturers...
Stop it. It's really... I mean, I press a button to start the car. No handbrake. That's a button. Everything's a button. When I'm driving the car to get to A to B, of course, you've got sat-nav. So they know how fast I'm travelling. They know where I'm stopping. You know, they know everything that I'm doing.
What would you...
And they know what, obviously, when I'm playing music, how loud I'm playing the music if I'm turning the radio station over. We can go on forever.
There has been some evidence from the United States, from DARPA, who are the people that invented the internet. They've got their own, I think it's called Defense Advanced Research Projects, something like that. That even just by plugging your car into a diagnostic port at the repairers, Volkswagen in this case, you can actually get a virus on your system. Just from Volkswagen.
Mm.
So this could all be their fault.
I know, but how can I prove it?
Also, apparently, what they said was that even putting a CD into the car, because it's connected to the computer...
That doesn't even work in anymore either. New car, supposed to have top of the range of everything, blah, 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 blah. That doesn't even work. I mean, if anything, it's scratching my discs. Maybe it doesn't like the type of music I'm playing, I don't know.
And, of course, parts of the car are, you know, you've got aerials, you've got wires, you've got ways of remotely accessing the computer. That is through some kind of, even through the radio.
Mm.
This is one of the things they said, is that people can actually get into your car's computer system remotely through an aerial or wire connection to
it. Well, that would be good.
And then start to control it as you're driving along.
I'd believe that, but to physically get into the car is virtually impossible. The RAC can't do it because I called them out before and I've locked the keys in the car. It's impossible. They are unable to get into that car. They've tried. Only way to get in would be to smash a window, but apparently that's quite difficult with those windows as well.
So you could hack into the car and you could be...
You could
right
yeah,
in
hack
the,
into
right
it, but you couldn't break into
you
it.
You couldn't actually
know.
Physically be in the car, yeah. But somebody else could be controlling the car's computer.
Yeah, how really scary. But for example, I open the boot up. So the car's open, I open the boot up. I didn't open the passenger door, okay? Open the boot up, done stuff in the boot, me being me, as usual. Put the keys in the boot, shut the boot. Car was locked. The windows were open an inch either side. Fortunately, no one was in the car. Couldn't get in. Had to pay absolute fortune to get the RAC out to try and open it. They couldn't open it, so we threw the little bits of the window. We had little bits of wire to unhook the back seats. Then we had to move everything that was in the back of the car, because I was camping, out to try and find the keys. There was no way to get into the car. He was trying all the locks on it and everything. He said these are one of the virtually impossible to break into. But I'm sure Volkswagen could have pressed a button, all the doors would have gone boop, boop, boop.
Okay, Cherie Townsend, thanks very much for joining us.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm very pleased to welcome back to the studio Ed Lander. Hi, Ed. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. It's good to be back.
Nice to say that. It's been a couple of months, hasn't it?
It's been
you
a while.
Come in this time to talk about a certain technical whiz kid called Aaron Schwartz, who I'm afraid is no longer with us.
Yeah, it's a very sad story. Aaron was a real protege, an incredibly gifted computer scientist who went on to achieve amazing and great things at a very early age, arguably achieved more in his sadly very short lifetime than a lot of people achieve in their entire lives. And yeah, he took his own life at the age of 26, unfortunately. It's a very sad story.
Now tell us a little bit about what he achieved, because I've seen at least that he was involved in something called Reddit on the internet. Now, first of all, what is Reddit?
Reddit is a popular news and community site. So Aaron came on board a little bit later. He had his own site at the time called InfoGamey. He'd also been involved earlier on with the development of RSS technology that allows you to tap into websites that you're interested in following.
Hang on, though. These RSS, what does it, you know what it stands for?
It stands for Rich Site Summary.
Right, so, okay, because I think we actually have an RSS feed on Dialect. When it goes up onto our Yahoo group, it sends out a little sort of pulse across the internet to anyone that's listening to say, this is what's on this show, and it's just arrived. So that was actually quite useful, wasn't it?
That's brilliant. And the key thing about Aaron is he achieved this, he was helping with this work at the age of 14. So that gives you some kind of an idea of quite how advanced and gifted he was in computer science. At the age of 13, he won a prize for non-commercial website design. This guy went on to become a prolific digital rights activist, and he ruffled some feathers. He really upset a lot of powerful people, and that's why people say he took the unfortunate decision to take his own life.
Now, I know he was involved in campaigning around two proposals over in the US, one SOPA and two PIPO. Now, what do they stand for?
SOPA is the Stop Online Piracy Act. PIPO is the Protect Intellectual Property Act. Those broadly were put together arguably to protect companies and their intellectual property, but a lot of people felt like they were clamping down the internet. They were shutting down the internet. They were shutting down freedom of speech. They'll be censoring websites, and the way in which websites would be blacklisted was a very non-democratic process. So quite rightly, lots of people like Aaron, who are very keen on freedom of the internet and freedom of information, felt deeply threatened and mobilized.
Well, it's all very well sharing things online, but what if you're actually sharing someone else's intellectual property and they would rather you didn't, and actually they're happy for you to have it, but they want you to pay for it?
It's a complicated topic. You know, a lot of companies make their money off protecting their intellectual property. You know, it gives them an advantage. Some companies have tried to have more open IP frameworks, and to be honest, they only really started getting a lot of traction and profitability once they moved to a more closed format.
Well, so what's the difference between an open IP framework and a closed format? I mean, what do you mean by that?
Well, there was an interesting company called MakerBot who make 3D printers, and their original founding principles were of openness and sharing all their intellectual property with the community, so that the community of MakerBot engineers could learn how they've designed their machines, and they could then improve upon it and submit it back to the community. And so they worked together. But when investors got on board, they said no. And they abandoned those principles, went closed.
Well, you know why, don't you? Because they say, well, we'll invest in this, but if it makes lots of money, we want that. We don't want it to be owned by the entire world. And so that's kind of understandable for an investor to say that.
It's predictable. Like you said, they're putting their money at risk, and so therefore they want to maximise the likelihood of returns on that.
There's another aspect to all of this, and that is that when a particularly controversial film is made, sometimes it's extremely enlightening. I'm just thinking, for example, at the moment, one of the ones I was watching recently was made by Yorkshire Television. It is a story about the Franklin scandal in the United States, which is child sexual abuse cover-up. It was never broadcast, but you can see why somebody who owns the intellectual property for that might be trying to suppress it, and they might say, well, we don't want anyone seeing this because we don't want the XYZ to be prosecuted. So there are all sorts of, you know, twists and turns into whether someone's intellectual property, it's right or wrong for them to be holding on to it and stopping anyone else using it.
There is a movement now with a lot of documentaries, particularly ones that are seen as in the public interest, to instead of locking them behind paywalls, to offer them free and find other streams and revenues of monetizing it, for example, just donations or crowdfunding. And I think that's actually a really good model, because it's great that everyone can learn, and that's what Aaron was fighting for aggressively. He had a reputation for going into public archives and ripping out information and putting them into the public domain. He would bypass these paywalls, and he upset numerous institutions in America doing this, so much that the FBI became aware of his activities and investigated him, and the courts found him that they acted in his favor. They said this information is public, therefore there's no reason why it can be copyright.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because quite a lot of that sort of information has actually been paid for out of the public purse.
Exactly.
And yet somebody somewhere is saying, well, we don't want anyone to have it. I mean, you're thinking immediately of the whole BBC archive. You know, that's been paid for from the license fee, which is public money. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is a public service broadcaster. Mm-hmm. And yet the BBC may possibly be suing people for using their material, or certainly stopping it being made available, which is another thing. So, I mean, if you go onto the BBC iPlayer, you see most of the programs, Current Affairs particularly, for some reason it cuts off after a day or after a week and it disappears. And so that's a bit naughty, BBC. You know, you really should make that stuff available to the public. But anyway, I better get off my anti-BBC high horse here. So what was Aaron actually doing with these public archives? Was he finding some sort of space on the internet and shoving all the archives from behind a paywall up for everyone to look at?
Yeah, that's exactly what he did. In one case, it was inspired. It just gives you an example of his brilliance, where he wrote a script in a programming language called Perl that went away and mined Amazon's cloud, and he just got all of this information together and then just put it on a public website for everyone. And in the famous case that got him in a lot of hot water with JSTOR, he went into an actual network switch housing cupboard and connected directly into MIT's network and was bulk downloading all these files. And presumably the FBI looked at his record and said, okay, this guy has a history of liberating all of this information. And, you know, this is a university. So he wanted to share all this information with the world. He wanted everyone to be able to benefit from it. He wanted us to advance as a species more quickly.
Interesting, isn't it? That he wasn't really into it for his own benefit. What a guy.
Yeah, he was incredible.
So you mentioned JSTOR there. What's that?
It's this online digital library, part of MIT. He was a fellow at Harvard University, so he had access to this. He had legitimate permissions, and allegedly this network switch cupboard wasn't locked, despite the fact he was arrested for breaking and entering and data theft and all these
so
things.
So he actually physically went in there and put a wire in so that he could then get access to this university, basically, essentially, a kind of university library of some sort.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And again, it had a paywall. There's a subscription service with JSTOR. So he was undermining their business model, basically. And let me read out something that was read out at his funeral that just, I think, gives you an idea of what a gifted and dangerous individual Aaron was, because combining all of those talents of computer science and his activism. Said Aaron had an unbeatable combination of political insight, technical skill, and intelligence about people and issues. I think he could have revolutionized American politics and beyond.
So why political? Why was this seen as something so political?
It was more to do with his work on Stop Online Piracy Act and PIPA. It was seen as a trend, a movement towards political mobilization. He'd given some very impressive speeches at some gatherings that he had organized himself. He was literally creating bodies and organizations and campaigns to fight this censorship and locking down of the internet. So I would say he was, as far as entrenched power structures are concerned, he was a dangerous and highly disruptive individual, but one of the most brilliant, and that's what's so tragic about his death.
But dangerous to who?
Dangerous to those who have vested interest and part of the existing power structure. He was incredibly disruptive.
Now, one thing about copyright, intellectual property, is that actually, for the most part, I'm not sure about the US, certainly here, it's a civil offence. If you're taking intellectual property, say, for example, you photocopy a book without permission, actually probably photocopying is a bit acceptable, but say for example you scan in some pages of a book and then that actually could be considered a copyright offence, but it's a civil offence. So in other words, the person that owns that copyright has to take you to the civil court, mm-hmm. and has to prove in front of a judge that you've suffered them damage and award you damages. And yet Aaron seems to have been it's not a civil judge. This is the FBI getting on his case. Yeah. What was going on there? Why is this considered such a serious matter when actually it should be just one citizen in the civil courts against another?
Yeah, I agree. I think originally it was going to be a civil suit, and I think there was even talk of a settlement. But then later on, the case was reopened at a state level, and I think it was spearheaded by the FBI. And forgive me for being cynical, but I think the FBI just decided to target him and try and make an example of these internet pirates, or whatever you want to call them.
Now, there are groups that campaign for this sort of thing, this kind of supporting people like Aaron. The Open Rights Group here in Britain is one of them, the Electronic Frontier Foundation in the US. Tell us a bit about the Open Rights Group, because I know that you've been following quite a lot of their work.
Yeah, I'm helping the Open Rights Group here in Bristol, just organising events, cinema events and so on. The Open Rights Group are a pretty well-established digital rights group. They lobby here in the UK. They have experts amongst the community who go and speak to MPs and so on and so forth. They're particularly interested in what GCHQ are doing in the UK, because they're particularly pernicious and overreaching in their surveillance activities, with the likes of Tempora, the fibre optic sniffing technology.
They want to know our passwords, don't they? They want to know everything about us. They want to know how to get into our bank accounts, our online accounts. They want to know everything, apparently. In fact, it was interesting because I think it was just a couple of weeks ago, Edward Snowden came out with another one of his online chat things that he does from Russia, live on the wall, a picture of Edward Snowden chatting away to you, was saying that actually GCHQ has got actually far more power in Britain than even the NSA has in America to take all of our information. That means they want to know everything.
Yeah, legally they seem to, and the Americans would definitely leverage that. But they share the same kind of technology. They have the most amazing technology that can identify a person's footprint across the internet through, say, even common passwords, obviously using the same email, that's fine, the same kind of search behaviors, scanning you through all the different social media platforms. They have a way to just take one snippet of information, like an email or a password or an alias, and then just bring up this whole picture on you. And it's totally comprehensive and very well established. And I fully support Edward Snowden blowing the whistle.
Yes, it's almost like the total information awareness. I remember seeing, this was a few years ago, the US launched this Office of Total Information Awareness, and with a kind of pyramid with an eye in the middle of it. You know, these guys want to know everything, you know, and it's almost like the Eye of Horus is looking at you. Everything you do, we know what you're up to. It just almost seems to me to be deliberately out there to spread fear. But anyway, I know you've got a film coming up later this week. Wednesday, I think, isn't it?
That's right, yes. Yeah. So on Wednesday, we'll be screening the documentary film about Aaron Swartz. It's called The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz. We'll be hosting that at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. We'll aim to start the film around 7 p.m. There'll be members of the Open Rights group there, local members, and everyone is welcome. It's a fantastic film. I haven't seen it yet, but it's got great reviews, and I'm really looking forward to watching it. So please do come see it and come and support the People's Republic of Stokes Croft and the Open Rights group.
So have you invited the FBI?
I'm sure they'll be watching remotely.
Okay, and how do people follow the Open Rights group? Is it easy to find online? Are there any? Do you actually meet physically, speak to each other, or are you just on kind of online chat things, encrypted or whatever?
Shocking, I know, but yeah, there are actually face-to-face meetings. This is one opportunity for people to get together and talk, and they have previously been purely chat-based meetings, and there's been hustings with MPs and so on. They have, the Open Rights group has got a very strong footprint online, with their own website. They're on Facebook. You can join very easily, and they have this conference coming up called ORGCon, which is the 15th and 16th of November, which is their annual digital rights conference, and that will be in London. So that will be people speaking all about digital rights and digital rights activism. It'll be quite an exceptional conference, I believe.
So have you got any evidence that the Open Rights group is a real, genuine campaigner for the internet, not just pretending to be?
Yeah, I've met one of the lawyers working on their behalf, and he looked very stressed and exhausted individual. He was campaigning hard against the Ripper Act, which has been modified to bring the law in line with what GCHQ have been doing, as opposed to the other way around.
It's interesting, isn't it? That's a bit naughty, that they sort of break the law, but then they change the law so that they're not breaking the law anymore.
it's that's pretty standard, I think. I think we've seen that in the banking sector as well.
Okay, well, anyway, lovely to see you again, Ed Lander. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now, for the first time, actually, we're going over to a friend of mine, Christian Payne. He blogs online as Documentally. He's a tech expert, gives talks to big companies around the world, and he's always seems to be flying. So you can follow him on Twitter at Documentally, DocumentallY. And here he's found somebody in the street he started chatting to, a very interesting chap called Peter William Bagley.
Just walking up through London. I'm only here for the day, and outside Whole Foods Market, I cannot help but notice a heavily laden bicycle, a bicycle that looks like it's done a fair few miles. And the owner of that bicycle has just popped out with shopping from Whole Foods Market. What's your name, sir?
Peter Bagley.
Peter Bagley?
Yeah.
That's an interesting name, considering how many bags you actually have. Is that your real name?
Yeah.
Can you tell me how you live?
Well, I've got equipment for if it snows or if it's minus 10.
So you are kitted out for all weathers?
Yeah.
I can't help but notice how many bags you have. I mean, is some of this shelter for living under? Is some of this food?
No, It's shelter, it's clothes, different types of clothes. I've got five different types of coats, depending on the conditions. Of course, you can overheat biking, so depends on the weather, what coat I wear.
Are these your worldly possessions?
Yeah.
How long have you been living on the road?
Most of the time for 14 years.
Was it a choice you made, or were you forced into it?
Well, I just sort of slipped into it because of circumstances.
Would you say it's a happy existence?
Well, it's an existence that I feel comfortable with.
What do you do for money? I've just popped into Whole Foods Market. It's not a cheap shop.
I had a road crash, so I get £304 a month, but I also, if I'm short of money, stick a cup out with a few coins in and I quite often get given money. Yesterday I wasn't anywhere around here, but the previous day I got given £10 odd without begging, and the previous day to that I got given £8. I also go to shops when they close so I can get food free.
Interesting. There is kind of like the freegan movement. There's a lot of food that gets thrown away.
Yeah. Well, a third of food is thrown.
A third of food is thrown. How does that make you feel?
Well, it's a waste of money.
A waste of money, a waste of food. And do you think people give you money because they feel sorry for you, or do you think they respect the fact that you've chosen a different way to live? Or
I don't know. They just give money to help out.
With £300 a month, you could well get yourself accommodation in one place. Has that ever crossed your mind?
Oh, I've had accommodation. Do you know anything about the Freemasons?
I do.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. Well, that lot control everything, and the more you know about them. Scotchman, when he's in the guards, worked for five. He said, "The more you know about them, the more they want to kill you." So if I'm in one place, they totally fuck things up. I've known five people who spend 2 to 4 weeks in any place because in accommodation they turned up without any warning, sectioned them, and totally. Totally mucking them up.
So, are you worried about getting sectioned yourself? Have you been?
Well, I'm not particularly worried, but at the time I'm aware it can happen. Because I've been warning people about Westminster Council, they turned up and lied, and they've had me banged up for 7 months. A first lister was corrupt. The second solicitor wasn't, so I got out on the tribunal, but they changed risperidone in a second when I said it was causing twitching in my face and mouth, but they then refused to change Landipan. A nurse told me he had four alternatives to Landipan. The internet's the sectioning is how they terrorise people to keep their mouth shut.
So did you not feel that the medication helps you at all to think straight?
Well, no. There wasn't one report from nurses that said I had any mental illness. But the chairman in the first tribunal said the psychiatrist's evidence was unconvincing. The nurse's report wasn't put in. He asked three times why. Well, the reason why it wasn't put in is that they'd have had to release me, you see. So it's the lies of the homeless people. The homeless people are corrupt.
I think people are interested in your story. Some people are watching me interview you. So living on the street, living on different streets and travelling around from place to place.
So now I'm safe for about 4 months, but after that they can... If I'm on my own in a place, so I'm going to have to be out of central London by about 8 o'clock at night.
So where do you go to? I mean, where do you find yourself travelling between?
Well, I'm not in good health because they've given me high cholesterol. They've given me angina, doctor said. They've mucked up my kidneys and my liver. but the bike is a £1,600 bike. Before I went in, I bought a 48, it's 42 cog. The bigger the front cog you have, the more inherent speed. But I'm waiting to get out of London because I bought a 44 before I knew about 48, and they swapped it round. Since I took legal action, they did it before, but I was with a GP in Ox City, so they moved me down there and let me out. Well, I haven't been to see him in 5 years, so as soon as the 5 years was up, you see, they take you off. So that's why they moved.
Are you on any medication right now?
Well, no, I've told them to get stuff.
And you feel better that way?
What?
And you feel better that way?
Well, for something he said in the tribunal means that for 4 months I'm going to have a reaction. I've got a lot of pain in my kidneys. By wearing a bag, my kidneys sweat, and that helps the kidneys. But it wouldn't change a olanzapine. I gave him 3 letters, heart, kidneys. It breaks down in some cases muscles. I've lost 7 stone. I've lost seven kilos of muscles. Now that releases a chemical that attacks your kidney. It also releases cholesterol. Now the cholesterol it's released is harmful.
So,
I mean, I eat 7 lumps of fruit a day. If I was in good health, I'd be biking 15, 20 miles. But it's a £1,600 bike.
Yeah, and it looks like you've done quite a fair few miles. The choice of going to this health food shop, is that because you are conscious of your health and you want to maintain your health?
Well, I've done that for a dozen years or more.
You don't seem to be the kind of person into, you know, the homeless stereotype, which is you're here because of drugs and alcohol.
No, I'm teetotal.
Teetotal?
Yeah.
Where next? Are you going to stay in London for a bit, or like you say, you need to get out?
Somebody from the homeless unit said that if you stay around, they'll do it again. Next time, they'll finish me off. So I got friendly with somebody who's involved in army intelligence. Now, he told me an organisation they controlled, but they appear to have closed it down, so I was going to look him up. People like that, I do know, can alter trials where the Incada is an organisation of the Illuminati, and it's also the organisation of Freemasons. Rosa Christos founded all levels of Freemasonry. Not all Freemasons are corrupt, but most of them, it depends what lodge they're a member of. Now they control things, you see. Now they know I know all about them. And I've been causing them a lot of grief by telling people, which is why they bang me up. They're saying because I know about the Freemasons and the Illuminati that I'm paranoid schizophrenic.
I can see how a lot of people would think that, but, you know, if people could see your facial expressions when I'm talking to you now. You are compos mentis in many ways, and smiling and engaging, if a bit thoughtful.
Well, there wasn't one nurse's report. My solicitor, second one, looked at the reports for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and there wasn't one that mentioned mental illness. So to avoid legal action, they've had to classify me. So they've said, because I believe... Now, one of the psychiatrists admitted to me that he knew about the Illuminati. So...
there's definitely a lot of documents out there. How much control the Illuminati, which I believe is an ancient organisation. Is it old, or is it...?
Yeah, the Illuminati have been around for several thousand years.
That was Peter William Bagley speaking to the interviewer Christian Payne, who blogs online as Documentally, not documentary, documentally. And that's Christian Payne chatting to him. We'll have more of that next week. That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Monday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Rita Lynch, Sherry Townsend, Ed Lander, and also Christian Payne interviewing Peter Bagley. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, so until the same time next week, goodbye for now.